from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
It just seems like there's something that is psychologically built into us to work, and that leisure does look really attractive. But it's on the basis of a rest
right.
from something. So it's a cessation of work that makes it attractive, but that work sets it up.
This is your host, Scott Bertrand. And that's Daryl Hart, our first guest on today's program. Daryl is Distinguished Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. He's recently written a piece at RealClearPublicAffairs.com titled The American Virtue of Hard Work. That's what we discuss here today. Dr. Hart, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Why is hard work an important American virtue? Does it help distinguish us from Europe?
In a sense, because we're not a class-based society, even though there'd be lots of people that criticize that. There is a sense in which the Horatio Alger myth really does make a lot of sense, and people work their way up. Even the immigrant narratives where people come here and make a way for themselves. The society is one in which, going back to colonial times, I guess, even, I would say, where people just distinguish themselves. You make a place for yourself. You make a way of life for yourself by your work. It doesn't depend on your status, on your family. Over time, those things matter.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's something basic, it seems to me, about that. And I would even add to that something that's hardwired into human beings. And if you believe the Bible accounts of creation, et cetera, that people are created to work. So there's just something about that. But America allows people to work and then actually accomplish things and potentially move up
mm-hmm.
in their social standing and have a better life for themselves. And so I think in that way, it's part of who Americans are. And it's also in some ways part of the American dream or myth or even national identity.
So you mentioned Benjamin Franklin in the piece. You use him as an American archetype of hard work. In what way does he exemplify what you're trying to get at?
Sheesh. Where do you start? I mean, the guy comes from really pretty hardscrabble conditions. I mean, his father was a candle maker, I believe it was. But they were by no means prominent. They came over from England in the later 17th century. And so they, like a lot of colonists, had to just make a way for themselves. Franklin was an apprentice to his brother in a print shop, and he had a kind of indentured relationship that he fought, and he actually had to escape from. People have compared it to a kind of slavery. So then he had to set out on his own, and he made his way on his own. Again, it's a kind of a typical American success story, even though it took him at least 4 years before he had his own printing press, the company that he's built. So between 1730 and 1750 or so, he's just printing everything he can get his hands on. And he has a lot of government contracts, which helps. And he makes himself into a gentleman by virtue of his hard work. He was an ambitious guy, but he just also had an inherent, innate curiosity about the way the world, nature, society, human beings worked. And so he was both a worker and fascinated by the way things worked. And so somehow that went together and was an amazing mix for him.
In what ways does the Protestant work ethic contribute to the American culture of hard work?
Part of it is, you could argue, is more American than Protestant. Because, again, losing the sort of hierarchy of conditions in European society and starting out sort of afresh. Of course, there were hierarchies in the colonies, Virginia maybe more so than Massachusetts, etc. But it's not as if those were egalitarian societies. Maybe Pennsylvania, was the most, although William Penn himself was by no means a minor figure. How much does the political situation of the United States starting in a colonial situation contribute to that, and again gets into the idea that people, if they're going to make the society work, they need to work.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you go back to the 16th century and Luther and the Reformation, you have this idea of vocation, which expands what had been a Western Christian idea beyond the vocation of priests or monks to include a vocation in a kind of religious sense of mothers, fathers, printers, mayors, farmers, so that people in those so-called secular occupations are actually serving God and serving neighbor, or as Luther would put it, loving God and loving neighbor. So these pursuits in the world, that it's not as if the Roman Catholic Church looked down on those, but there is this kind of hierarchy of piety or sanctity with priests and monks doing the really religious stuff and the other mm-hmm. people maybe doing something less religious, and Protestants sort of open that up and say, no, you can actually, I mean, Luther's idea, the priesthood of all believers, so that a mother changing diapers is as much a priest as mm-hmm. the priest who's preaching the homily or something. And so that kind of opens it up in a way. Now, that can go off in secular ways as well, and people can forget about the religious vocations. But still, I think that's kind of a religious side of it.
Talking with Daryl Hart, Distinguished Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale. His piece is at realclearpublicaffairs.com, The American Virtue of Hard Work. If we were to decide to prioritize leisure, how would that change American culture?
Off the top of my head, it would actually hurt leisure. Because, I mean, the people who work, as I understand it, on movies and the sorts of things that people have been streaming during the pandemic, which is, you know, has kind of helped us get through it. People had to work to do that. People have to be creative, have to be entrepreneurs, have to secure funding for all this. So the idea of somebody's going to have to work to create some of the things that we need.
Mm-hmm.
So it would drastically change things. I think people derive, although you hear more and more statistics now, and it really will be curious to see how this plays out with people leaving work, not going back to work.
Right. Right.
But I do think that people search for meaning in all sorts of ways, such as, say, even social justice or climate change or something. I mean, I think people believe in a larger cause like that, and it can give them purpose. But I think for much of American history, if not even before that, people have derived a lot of meaning from the work that they do. Now, again, it can get out of hand, and people become workaholics and forget and neglect all the other things that they do in life and the other responsibilities they have. But I do think if we're hardwired, say, from creation on, in the created order that God has ordained, if we can say those sorts of things, I think we can here at Hillsdale, but then it just seems like there's something that is psychologically built into us to work, and that leisure does look really attractive, but it's on the basis of a rest from something. So it's a cessation of work that makes it attractive, but that work sets it up, and I think that's the great energy of leisure. It's dependence on work.
Would you consider, do you think hard work is a conservative value, a conservative virtue?
I hesitate because of the partisan configuration conceivably of that, and I don't want to make something that I think is something shared by left and right, all human beings, as it were, into something. But I would say that conservatives, I think, have defended this and looked at it more carefully in some ways, perhaps, than at least the criticisms of work, the people arguing for the UBI, is that what, the universe?
Yes. Universal Basic Income.
Right, thank you. Seem to be coming more from the left than the right. And, you know, I just think there's something really curious about that proposal.
Daryl Hart, Distinguished Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. You can find his piece at realclearpublicaffairs.com, The American Virtue of Hard Work. Daryl, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be with you, Scott. Thanks.
Up next, we talk with Randy Barnett about his new book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We welcome your feedback and comments to contact the program. Email us, radiohour@hillsdale.edu. radiohour@hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Randy Barnett. He is a professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center, also co-author, along with Evan Burnick, of the new book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, Its Letter and Spirit. Randy, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Scott, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment is the new book. We have to, I'm sure many of our listeners are aware, but we have to make sure we cover our bases. Tell us, what's the 14th Amendment, and why is it so important?
Yeah, the 14th Amendment is the most famous, important amendment that your listeners have never heard of. But they're familiar with 14th Amendment challenges without knowing it. So every time there's a First Amendment freedom of speech challenge to a state law, every time there's a First Amendment free expression challenge to a state law, every time there's a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms challenge to a state law, none of those are First or Second Amendment cases. They are all 14th Amendment cases. Why? Because the first 10 amendments that we call the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states at the founding. Those rights only became applicable to the states because of the passage of the 14th Amendment 68. So all of these lawsuits that you hear about challenging the constitutionality of state laws, almost every single one of them is a 14th Amendment challenge.
And when we hear that phrase that we often do, equal protection under the law, this is what we talk about when we mention the 14th Amendment, right?
Yes. Their 14th Amendment has five sections. The ones that we really are concerned with are Sections 1 and Section 5. And Section 1 is divided up into four parts. And I should mention, the 14th Amendment is the longest amendment we've got. And the four parts are the Citizenship Clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, the Due Process of Law Clause, and the Equal Protection of the Laws Clause. These are four working parts of Section 1. And then Section 5 creates an enumerated power in Congress to enforce the provisions of Section 1. And so there's actually a congressional power that is created by Section 5 to enforce the provisions of Section 1.
When we look at the 14th Amendment, Randy, in the original meaning, the concepts of natural rights, the Declaration itself, how did they inform the writing, the original intent of the 14th Amendment?
They very profoundly, because the founder, the authors of the 14th Amendment, the Republicans who are responsible for the 14th Amendment, were strong believers in natural rights, and natural rights was one of the principal arguments that was used against the injustice of slavery, and the Republican Party was formed to be an anti-slavery party. So natural rights played a very important role, and natural rights played a very important role in what was considered to be the privileges or immunities of national citizenship. Basically, the argument was that when you enter into civil society, you get a civil right to the legal protection of your natural rights. And it was a violation of the privileges or immunities of citizens to fail to protect their natural rights, the natural rights that they retain when they enter into society. So natural rights are behind the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which means they're behind the 14th Amendment. And by eliminating that clause, they've thrown into doubt in the minds of many whether the 14th Amendment actually does protect our natural rights, which we think it clearly does.
Was there an assumption on the founders' part, the framers' part, that threats to our liberty would come from, say, the federal government, not the state government, and was the 14th Amendment a response to that?
Yes, there was a fundamental shift in assumptions. At the founding, there was a great fear of a federal government, of a consolidated government, of a strong national government, and the states were thought to be the ultimate defenders of liberty against federal or national encroachment. But because of the slavery question, in which states were the perpetrators of slavery laws, that it eventually came to be thought that it needed to be a federal presence or a federal resistance to these laws. And in fact, the slave power also used the federal government when they passed the Fugitive Slave Acts to use federal power to protect slavery as well. But by the time we get to the Civil War, the federal government starts to be thought of as the protector of the rights of the people against their own states. That was a thought that wasn't popular at the founding. Madison had that idea. Madison proposed something like that be put in the Bill of Rights, but the Congress didn't do it. But by the time we get to the 14th Amendment, now the federal government is thought to be the protector of our individual rights from being violated by our own states.
Randy Barnett is with us. The new book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, its letter and spirit. I saw you write the other day that this book in particular is attempting to look at the original public meaning of the 14th Amendment rather than the original expected application. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. For many years, conservatives, this was back in the 1970s and 80s, would be originalists, although that word did not exist at that time, by looking at what they would ask, what would the framers do, or JMD, what would James Madison do? So you have a particular case that comes before you, you say, what would the framers do about this? And that was not a historical question. That was what you might call a counterfactual hypothetical question. It was a thought experiment. But for the last 30 years, originalism has moved away from that into asking what is the public meaning of the text of the Constitution. So let me put this in concrete terms. When Brown versus Board of Education was argued, the Supreme Court asked the parties to brief what the founders would have expected with respect to segregated schools. And the answer they got back from historians was, well, we're not sure, and the Supreme Court said the historical evidence was inconclusive. What they did not ask, and what they should have asked, is what was the original public meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and was the right to attend a government-created school free of discrimination one of the privileges of national citizenship? If they had asked that question, they would have found that originalism supported the outcome in Brown versus Board of Education, rather than thinking that originalism or the original intent of the framers was inconclusive.
Randy, if our justices on the Supreme Court adopt the thinking behind this book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, what would be the tangible application of that? How might justices look at cases differently in the future?
All right, there's two big consequences. The most important consequence is it's going to legitimate a lot of what the court already does, but they do it under the wrong clauses. Like, for example, apply the First Amendment to the states, apply the Second Amendment to the states. There are many conservatives who question the legitimacy of what's called incorporation. And in fact, that's the easiest thing to justify under the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, that the freedom of speech, press, assembly, and free exercise of religion did apply to the states via the 14th Amendment. So that's the number one thing. It legitimates doctrines that are currently very popular, but are controversial amongst conservatives. But the second thing it would do is it would require that government be more skeptical, that the courts be more skeptical about restrictions of all kinds of liberties beyond those enumerated rights. Like, for example, economic liberties of the kind that have been severely restricted by government fiat, for example, during this COVID epidemic, where you have governors shutting down businesses. And unless those shutdown orders have some effect on the free exercise of religion, courts simply won't touch them. But they need to touch them if the 14th Amendment is going to be respected.
Randy Barnett is the co-author of the new book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, Its Letter and Spirit. Evan Burnick is the co-author. Randy, also a professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center. Randy, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
So it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Peter Jennings, Associate Professor of Management here at Hillsdale College, about leadership and military service and the book Once an Eagle. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drought. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
As part of Operation Holiday Salute, Reading Kia would like to take this moment to thank our veterans and those currently enlisted in the military for their service. Since 2006, Reading Kia has set out to be the premier automobile dealership in the North State. There's always a military incentive rebate on all new 2022 Kias at Reading Kia. Test drive the 2022 Kia Sorento today. Reading Kia, home of the 20-year, 200,000 limited-mile powertrain warranty. 418 East Cypress Avenue, ReadingKia.com.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe, or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
One 100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Building on our foundational promise to educate ministers and missionaries, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Hi, this is Matt with Liberty Unabashed. It's time to embrace American values. Our society is based on the freedom, not begging the government for permission. It's time to wake up, my brothers and sisters. Come check out my show every other Sunday, 8 to 9, Liberty Unabashed.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
River Film Playhouse presents It's a Wonderful Life, a radio play based on the story The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern and adapted by Joe Landry, directed by John Welsh. This beloved holiday classic comes to life as a 1940s radio broadcast. Join the cast and bring a few dozen characters to the stage as the story of George Bailey unfolds one fateful Christmas Eve. December 3rd through the 18th at the new Riverfront Playhouse, downtown on California Street. Tickets available online at riverfrontplayhouse.net. Brought to you by Cornerstone Bank and this station.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Peter Jennings, Associate Professor of Management and Brower D. and Jane E. McIntyre Chair in Business Administration at Hillsdale College. Also served as an infantry officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. Dr. Jennings, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And we talked today about a book. It's a big book.
Yes, sir.
It's called Once an Eagle by Anton Meyer. And you consider it to be our great American military epic.
Yep.
Why do you say so? Why do you think that?
Well, it's a big book, so I guess it's a fanatic. It has to be a big
book. It
meets
the definition.
A long book. As a military guy, this is a book that's had enormous influence over the American military since it was published in 68. Its influence has waned a little bit, I think, in the last decade, but it was certainly hugely influential to me. I think my take is this is the American Iliad. This is our Iliad, an epic of great significance in that sense. And I think that for a few different reasons. First of all, it's a book, and if it's going to be a book of any worth, it's got to be a great read.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a simple entry point into this, but it's just a great story. It's a great read. I think of it in movie or video terms. This book captures my imagination, my military imagination, the same way Saving Private Ryan did in the movies, or that series Band of Brothers, the way those videos, those movies capture your imagination, just great stories. Once an Eagle is like that. So I think that's a requisite, an ante, if it's going to be a great book. But more seriously, in terms of why I think this is an epic, and what I mean by that is it has some greater cultural significance to us. The topic, it's about war. War is a subject of enormous human importance. It's been with us from the beginning. It'll be with us till the end, for sure. And it deals seriously, substantively with this topic. It teaches some important truths about war, I think. Third reason I think this is specifically an American epic is it deals with an especially important period in our American military history from just before World War I to the early years of Vietnam, a period of time where the American military really grew up, came of age in World War I, achieved a measure of greatness in World War II, and then withered and declined in the Vietnam era. So it covers that span, which is an important period in American history. And I think the final thing that makes this an epic is it tells this great story of the American military through this important period of time, primarily through two characters, really compelling characters, who, this is where I get the Iliad analogy. If the two main characters in the Iliad are Hector and Achilles, well, in this book, we have Sam Damon and we have Courtney Massengale, and they're loosely analogous to Achilles and Hector. They're very compelling characters that capture your imagination, and through these characters, they drive the narrative that pulls you in, that takes you along through this incredible story of the American military in this vital period of time.
Before we find out a bit more about those characters, you've taught a course on this book. You recommend it for Hillsdale students who are interested in military service. What is that main differentiator between Once an Eagle and the other military books that are out there?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't teach this to the exclusion of many others, but this is for me, for this informal little military program that I'm a part of here. We have a significant body of students that are interested in pursuing commissions in the armed forces after they graduate, and we don't have an ROTC program. So myself and a couple other professors teach classes that help our students prepare for military, for commissioning. A lot of what these students will learn in their military training once they commission is technical.
Mm-hmm.
Technical knowledge and skill. They got to be competent. They got to learn their jobs as an infantry officer, artillery, whatever it is. That's really important. And a lot of their early military training that they get as officers focuses on technical competence, knowledge, and skill. Vitally important. But what gets lost in their career, especially with their anxiety to learn their jobs, to not screw up, to do well, is they lose something that I think is fundamentally important to being an American military officer. And it's this question of what does it mean to actually be? Not do. Be an American. What is distinctive? What is the distinctive oath, ethos, the norms, the values, the commitments, the principles that should guide and govern the character of an American military officer? And I use this book because it highlights very sharp contrasts of a good officer and a bad officer, very different concepts of what it means to be an officer and the character of an American military officer. And it helps students, I use the book to help students cultivate a vision for themselves as an American military officer.
Talking with Dr. Peter Jennings about the book Once an Eagle. So tell us about our main characters here, Sam Damon and Courtney Massengale, who help us move the story forward. Where do we see the contrasts between these two?
The contrasts jump out right in their names. Courtney Massengale, Sam Damon. Sam Damon's the good Midwestern Nebraska farm kid. He's got a nice solid name with those Midwestern values. Courtney Massengale, East Coast guy from Privilege. So right there, just a simple contrast just in the names right there. But on a more serious level, there's two points to make about the names. The first, on a more substantive level, the contrast comes in their concepts of their career, how they envision their careers, their ambition, fulfilling their, they're both ambitious guys. They're both talented. They're both smart. They're ambitious, and they want to be successful officers. But their whole concept of what does it mean to be a military officer, their concept of their career is very different. Courtney is a politician, a careerist. He's into politics and playing the power game and climbing the ladder that way. Sam, you know, Midwestern Nebraska guy, is a yeoman officer. He works. He's in the field. He's your... there's a contrast in the book between line and staff. Sam Damon is your line officer who's in the field with his soldiers fighting, living in the conditions that, and he proves himself to be a great hands-on American troop leader.
Mm-hmm.
He's committed to the mission, committed to troop welfare, leads from this front, sets an example, and he's in the thick of it, right? So that's one exemplar of a military officer. And then Courtney's a staff guy. And he's not in the field, but he's playing the staff politics and trying to climb that way. That's kind of a superficial description, but that's the sharp contrast right there.
So what does Once an Eagle want to tell us about these characters who have similar goals, similar concept of what they want from their careers, but have different paths and pay different prices to reach that goal?
I think there are a number of themes or lessons I think Meyer's trying to convey in the book is important. So this isn't history; it's historical fiction.
Right.
So it's fiction, but it's historical. It's grounded in history, but it's fiction. And he's trying to tell a compelling story here with some lessons. I think there are a number of different lessons. One is just about war, and Meyer has a very dark, pessimistic, cynical view of war. And I think the second main lesson is about the people who fight wars, the war fighters. And not all the war fighters are good, like Massengale. I think Meyer has particular contempt for people like that. But he has a great admiration and respect for the guys that do the dirty work of fighting our wars, like Sam Damon.
Mm-hmm.
And their goodness, their virtue, their simple but important virtues of duty and honor and loyalty and courage. And so I think the two main lessons, the 1-2 punch I take from the book is let's not romanticize war. And Meyer's very clear. This is a very anti-war book. He thinks war is a awful, destructive thing that's a product of human vainglory and pride and folly. That's a very clear message in the book. But also it's a very clear message that he has great admiration for those men and women who do our dirty work for us, who pick up the rifle and go get the job done that has to be done at great sacrifice.
We'll pause right there and continue our conversation next with Hillsdale Professor Peter Jennings as we discuss leadership, military service, and the book Once an Eagle. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Make this New Year's Eve a night to remember at the Reading Garden of Lights. Featuring 2 stages of live music, food trucks and bars throughout the gardens provided by Mosaic, all surrounded by a magnificent holiday light show. Tickets available at turtlebay.org.
This holiday season, begin a whole new tradition of lights and festivities for the entire family at Reading Garden of Lights. Taking place November 19th through December 31st at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens by the Sundial Bridge in Reading, California. Explore 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens featuring over 1 million lights, plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more. Reading Garden of Lights, November 19th through December 31st, presented by Mercy Medical Center Reading. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
a jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed, a new show on Sundays, 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
Since 1890, Stifel has established itself as one of the nation's leading wealth management and investment banking firms by understanding clients' hopes and dreams, focusing on building and preserving wealth. Simply put, when you achieve your goals, we achieve ours. I'm proud to be a part of Stifel as a financial advisor. This is Susan Eastman, First Vice President Investments. Call today for quality time well spent. 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868. 221-5868. MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Hi, I'm Rob Burrows from the Homeward Bound Military Family Support Services. Your donations helped us deliver 125 Thanksgiving dinners to military families in need. We're taking donations for Christmas meals December 18th and 19th, again at Save Mart on Turn Creek Road in Redding. Donate hams, turkeys, and non-perishable dry goods and canned goods that would make a wonderful Christmas dinner. Cash accepted also. Keep the dates December 18th and 19th at Save Mart from 8 to 8 both days. And thanks for your support.
Seco Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're talking with Dr. Peter Jennings, Associate Professor of Management here at Hillsdale College, about leadership, military service, and the book Once an Eagle. There are leadership lessons here in Once an Eagle as well. How do we learn about selfless versus self-serving leaders?
Yeah, so there are a lot of, throughout the book, there's a lot of scenarios, if you want to call it that, that are great for discussions with the students about good and bad leadership, examples of each. And with Sam, you know, you find many good examples. And a lot of those examples, I think primarily the best examples, and this is another reason why it's good for students who are commissioning for the junior tactical level officer, there's a lot of great little scenarios that you can discuss with your students at a tactical level, troop leading level, sergeant, lieutenant, squad leader, platoon commander kind of level, whether tactical combat situations or garrison or, you know, other situations. There's just all kinds of things you can dissect and talk about with your students to illustrate the leadership principles we learn in the Marine Corps, the military, about taking responsibility, leading from the front, setting an example, completing a mission, that kind of thing, and all the traits. And then there's a lot of bad examples throughout the book as well. Many of those are Courtney Massengale and the careerism, the politics, and a lot of that is the you know, the thorn in the side of military careers. It's always been there, the politics, that part of it. So there's just scenario situations throughout the book that are great little discussion situations with your students to kind of analyze and peel them apart and get down to the underlying values and commitments that are governing how these various officers or soldiers are dealing with situations.
You mentioned earlier the book also is a reflection, can be a reflection on how the U.S. military grew and changed along with the country during this time period of World War I through Vietnam. Is there a lamentation here that perhaps there are fewer Sam Damons? I'm sorry, fewer Sam Damons, more Courtney Massengales as time goes on, at least in this time period?
When I read the book, I do get a sense of innocence lost. You know, we grew up as a country, as almost a fledgling, aspiring professional military in World War I to really achieving a level of greatness in World War II, and then falling off in Vietnam. And in my generation, the Gulf, starting with the Gulf War, one of the things that we celebrated, whether it was fully deserved or not, was how we rebuilt and achieved and, you know, restored ourselves to the standard that had been set in World War II. There is in the book sort of that rise and fall kind of theme worked into it, and there is a sense of something lost. The world after World War II is far more bureaucratic, technological, complex, as opposed to the simpler days, the days in when a man's physical presence made a difference and it was more important. You look at it today, I was just doing some work over the summer on Hillsdale College and Civil War, and vast majority of soldiers in Civil War were infantry, 80%+. Now that's reversed. You know, more of us spend time behind computers, pounding keyboards, or doing other administrative technological things. And there's something, I think, in my reading the book, there's perhaps it's just nostalgia on my part, but we've lost something. The more sedentary, technological, bureaucratic, organizational that we've become, we've lost touch with some of those basic core grounded yeoman kind of virtues. Meyer shares that lamentation too in some separate interviews that he did on the book, because he grew up at a time when he grew up with men like that, that could farm and fix things and build things and could hunt. And today we make fun of that rugged American individual. We ridicule it. I think we're fools to ridicule it. I think there's an important truth there in our history, in our tradition, in our heritage. That's another reason why I teach the book. The book gives us a glimpse into our heritage. And sort of like Moses in Deuteronomy teaching the Israelites, teach, learn, don't forget this. Because when you forget, you're going to go astray. And in reading these books, I'm going on a little bit long here, but in the battle scenes in the book, the book is celebrated for his descriptions of battle. And what you gain appreciation for is the human side of war. That at the end of the day, it's men, it's women, their blood, their sweat, their tears, in the ground in insane conditions who fight wars. And, all right, we have drones, and you can sit 2,000 miles away behind a keyboard and launch missiles. I don't know. I think at some point in time we're going to need men and women who are willing to pick up a rifle, get in the dirt, and do the hard fighting, and we're going to need those rugged values that Sam Damon exemplifies. And God, I hope that we have young people who have them when we need them.
Talking with Dr. Peter Jennings about Once an Eagle. I want to come back to that point in a moment, but now might be a good time to ask about the author himself, Anton Meyer. What's his story? What should we know about him?
Yeah, I alluded to this a little bit earlier. He's a very interesting guy for me, not just because I'm a Marine and he is a former Marine. He was a Harvard College student before the war. And, I think kind of a middle-class kind of guy. He wasn't, part of the elite East Coast, but a middle and kind of an artistic bent. Obviously, he became an author after the war. But he was at Harvard and enjoying college life there before the war, a simpler, more romantic time. The war came, Pearl Harbor. It was something they all felt was coming, and it came, and he was part of that generation that volunteered, that enlisted. He wanted to get into an officer program. He was rejected, so he enlisted in the Marines. I think he somewhat regrets that he did that. But he ended up an infantryman, was promoted to an NCO. He's a corporal, was involved in some of the island campaigns, was seriously wounded in Guam, eventually received a medical discharge honorably, and finished his education at Harvard and became an author after the war, wrote several books. And this is probably his most renowned, his greatest book. War, as you can imagine, not surprisingly, had a profound impact on him. And he admits he went in with what he describes as kind of a flamboyant perspective, perhaps a romantic view of war that a lot of young people have. And the brutal war in the Pacific shattered that. And he says he came out of that with a very cynical, pessimistic view that war is just an evil, cynical, corrupt thing. So he had a very dark view of war after his experience in the Marines. But as I mentioned earlier, he also saw some good in the war, specifically in the war fighters. Not all of them, like the Martinet soldiers, he calls them, like Courtney Massengale. He had contempt for people like that. But the guys, I think a lot of the Marines he served with and some of the officers he served with, he saw the good in this cesspool of war. The good, I think of, Meyer doesn't make this analogy, but I make this analogy. His view of war is kind of like the cross. And for Christians, for biblical, we understand the cross as it symbolizes two things. The evil, the degradation, the corruption of humanity. The one innocent man, we kill him. War is like that. But in the cross, we also see the greatness, the goodness of humanity and Christ's humanity, who sacrifices his life for others. No love greater than that. I think that's what Meyer sees in war. He doesn't use this analogy, it's my analogy, but he sees the cross. He sees the evilness, the destructiveness, the vileness of humanity, and amidst that cesspool, you see the beauty, the glory, the goodness, that human beings actually can love the way Christ teaches us.
Dr. Peter Jennings, Associate Professor of Management, Broward D. and Janie McIntyre Chair in Business Administration. He served as Infantry Officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, and we talk about Once an Eagle by Anton Meyer. Dr. Jennings, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Daryl Hart from Hillsdale's History Department, talking about his recent essay on the American virtue of hard work. We also heard from Randy Barnett and his new book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment. And we heard from Peter Jennings on leadership, military service, and the book Once an Eagle. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbinshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week,
I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is the Cigar of the Month from Tobacco and Brew, brought to you by Liga Privada. The Underground Sungrown is the perfect balance of Nicaraguan long filler tobacco. Draped in a lovely Connecticut sungrown wrapper, this stick received a 92 rating. With hints of spice, wood, and espresso, this robust cigar ends on notes of cinnamon. Come down to the best cigar shop around, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Turn your someday into today. The Shasta College spring semester begins January 19th, and now's the time to register for classes. First-time, full-time students, get your first 2 years tuition-free. At Shasta College, we'll teach you the skills, give you the knowledge, and provide the training you need to unlock your potential. Reskill, upskill, or get transfer-ready at Shasta College. Go to www.shastacollege.edu/apply.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Hi, I'm Janet McCarn, one of the owners of Orchard Nutrition Center. We are proud to be joining KCNR in sending holiday greetings and wishes to all our veterans and those currently serving our country, and to their families waiting at home. It is a huge sacrifice they make for our country, and Orchard Nutrition Center is proud to honor our veterans every day with a 10% in-store discount. Sending warm wishes from the Orchard Nutrition Center family to all our veterans today and all year long. Thank you for your service.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Redding, 222-8222.
Good morning, Redding. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. With all the talk about gun control and stripping firearms rights from law-abiding citizens, I just want you to remember that our country was founded on the idea that we would each be accountable to ourselves and each other for the safety of our society. Another important responsibility we have is a safe and effective use of a firearm. If that is your choice, give NFI a call at 999-1822 or find and register for one of our popular CCW courses at usgunpro.com. Remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
I expected it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading
by Shasta Regional.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.